American Honda Motor Company. Is it Mr. Subar?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Lauren Subar, and I'm pleased to represent Christy Williams, appellant herein and the plaintiff below. I respectfully reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning the course of the argument today, I want to share a brief quote from a case in which you, Judge, Chief Judge Richmond, were part of a panel just a few months ago in Rosvi versus Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. The court said, "We have cautioned that inherent powers may be exercised only if essential to preserve the authority of the court, and the sanction chosen must employ the least possible power adequate to the end proposed. If there is a reasonable probability that a lesser sanction will have the desired effect, the court must try the less respective measure first. We emphatically state that sanctions should be used lightly and should be used as a lethal weapon under only extreme circumstances. In this case, the first and only sanction not only ordered by the court, but ever considered by the court below was a litigation-ending sanction. In this case, the district court made the following errors. First, the district court was in error in striking the plaintiff's liability expert as a discovery sanction. Second, the district court was in error in then using that sanction to dismiss Ms. Williams' lawsuit with prejudice. The two topics I want to cover today are first, whether the sanction imposed in striking plaintiff's liability experts was a litigation-ending sanction. The second is whether the evidence before the district court and stated in the court's order met this court's heightened standard for issuing a litigation-ending sanction. For the first issue, whether striking the experts was a litigation-ending sanction, this court's own title for what some courts call a death penalty sanction, but what this court terms a litigation-ending sanction, makes the issue clear. Specifically, was the sanction ordered by the district court striking plaintiff's liability experts in a product liability action where the expert testimony was a required element for proof, did that end the litigation? For that answer, the court need look no further than the second sentence, of the district court's summary judgment, where the district court noted that if the court struck plaintiff's experts as a sanction, it would terminate the litigation. This court has consistently held that when determining whether a sanction is a litigation-ending sanction, that the court can look at one or two contemporaneous documents. This was precisely the holding in Law Funder versus Munoz, where the court considered a sanctions order executed contemporaneous with a dismissal as being a single litigation-ending sanction. Other courts in the Fifth Circuit have more clearly stated the understanding of this court. Earlier this year, in Lara versus Power of Grace Trucking, a court in Louisiana said, "The Fifth Circuit mandates when a sanction is of such substantial effect that it would spell doom for the case, the sanction is a litigation-ending sanction. Years earlier in EEOC versus General Dynamics, this court recognized that, in fact, in striking an expert in a product liability case where that expert's testimony would be necessary to prove the case, that the court still had to go through a heightened level of scrutiny to determine whether the sanction was correct. And I would very briefly, even though that this is a procedural issue, not a substantive issue, I would at least mention that under Texas law, with regard to the same issue, the Texas courts have specifically stated that when an expert is struck and that expert's testimony is necessary to prove a case, that is a death penalty sanction. There are two constitutional issues that are of concern in this case. The first is one stated by this court many times. We cannot and must not say that the ends justify the means at the expense of our constitutional rights. Yet ignoring that warning, the court the district court made that very ruling. While it sounds like a harsh assessment, I would again invite the court to look at the first or second sentence of the summary judgment, where the court says that if it strikes the if and not when, or because it strikes the experts, then and it says strikes, not struck, the experts, then there would be sufficient evidence, there would be insufficient evidence to proceed with the case, and the dismissal followed.
Theory is that a sanction that, by all indications, is a discovery sanction, nevertheless becomes litigation ending based on the underlying subset of law that we're applying to that case. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely.
Is it strange, though, to recharacterize a discovery sanction as something other than a discovery sanction in one case based on substantive law, when in another case, nobody would ever treat it as that?
Well, I think...
Why isn't it more sensible just to say it's a discovery sanction that simply has broader consequences?
I don't know. And the reason I say that is that I will tell you, first of all, needless to say, most of my cases I was looking at were discovery sanctions. And secondly, even in when the court considers other dismissals without prejudice, like under Rule 60, the court again has gone several times has gone through that same Connor analysis.
Do you have any case where we or another circuit has treated a discovery sanction as a litigation ending sanction?
Where they've treated a discovery sanction as a litigation sanction? I think actually the vast majority of the cases that I've cited have been, because they've been cases where specifically they've talked about either not producing deposition testimony, not answering discovery. I think
are all the so-called death penalty sanctions that were in vogue in the 80s and 90s, as I recall, and the court dismissed the case as a discovery sanction. So the sanction itself was case-ending because the court said it was. It said your punishment for failure to disclose these documents is I'm going to dismiss your case, or I'm going to enter default judgment against you. That's not what happened here.
And I agree with you, Your Honor, that prior to to FDIC versus Connor, that's exactly what the court many times was ruling. And I think that's where that there's that separation between what happened before FDIC versus Connor and after FDIC versus Connor, where that becomes crucial definer, is that the court said, look, you have to go through these four specific tests in order to, before you can consider a death penalty sanction.
Well, I take your point that excluding an expert is not a dismissal of the case, but it could result in the death of the case where you have to have an expert to prevail. I take your point. But, you know, we have said over and over again, if you don't meet your discovery, the pretrial order deadlines, the court can exclude witnesses, period. Haven't we said that?
That is correct, Your Honor, except for the fact that then you have to look at those two principles together. I think that if you look at them separately in a vacuum, I don't disagree. When you look at the two principles together, the fact is that before you can dismiss a case with prejudice as a discovery sanction, you have to go through that process. So I absolutely agree with the court that generally you have to go and follow the discovery rules. Discovery orders of the court. I don't disagree with that at all. But when those orders are not followed, what the courts have said is that what this court has said is that before you issue that ultimate sanction, you have to go and consider lesser sanctions. And in fact, not only did the trial court not consider lesser sanctions, the court never even mentioned considering the lesser sanctions. In fact, in the...
If a baseball umpire mistakenly, let's just concede, mistakenly calls a strike rather than a ball at the end of the game, would we call that... We wouldn't say that umpire is calling a forfeiture of the game. It's still just a ball or strike call, isn't it?
Correct, but
so what's the difference here?
Well, and again, that's exactly the argument that the defendant has made.
Right.
But you have to look at the, not just at that specific ruling, you have to look at what the effect of the ruling is, and this court and the under...
In the baseball court, analogy, the effect of mistakenly calling a strike in the ninth inning, you know, on the two outs, two strikes, the effect of that is to forfeit the game, under your theory. But nobody would say that the umpire has declared a forfeiture. They would just say the umpire made a ball or strike call.
Well, but there is a difference because, again, the rules as set forth by this court have, in fact, set forth different rules with regard to your ball and strike analogy is very black and white. But this court has gone and made it very clear.
No, let's say that the rules of Major League Baseball say that for an umpire to call that a game is forfeited requires unanimous ruling of all the umpires on the field. Does that mean that the final ball or strike call has to be done unanimously? I would think the answer is no, because it's not a forfeiture call, it's a ball or strike call, even though the consequences of that ball or strike call happens to be the end of the game.
Okay.
Oh. And I assume you agree with that.
My
only question then is, why is this case any different from my analogy?
Well, because again, it's because it's not a baseball game, Your Honor, and there are other contingencies that have been exigencies that have been recognized. Things like the fact that, again, this was not as happens in a lot of these cases. And in fact, a case I think that you were on, Vicus, earlier this year, where we're talking about perjury. We're talking about they actually used the term anarchy to introduce the. To introduce the matter when they started talking about litigation ending sanctions. This was the first time that the parties were ever physically in front of the court, but they'd never been in front of the court with regard to anything even mentioning sanctions beforehand. And the courts and this court and others have recognized that there has to be some progression, especially when you're talking about, figured I'd be addressing it in rebuttal, but I'll address it now. But especially in a matter such as this, where while the precipice, the thing that led to the sanction was this email canceling
court seemed pretty upset about that.
Pardon?
District court seemed pretty upset about that.
Well, and I agree with that, Your Honor. But the fact of the matter is that unfortunately, that it was a poorly worded email shot from the hip, but the reality is, and one that the district court didn't take into consideration, was the entirety of the record as to why that occurred. And
you understand, we typically don't get into the business of the district courts making this type of call.
There's
a pretty deferential approach that we typically take.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I don't question, that's part of what I said, in fact, in the prayer, which was, look, I'm not questioning whether the court had the right to go and sanction for what for the plaintiff going and canceling the deposition, and I'm not questioning whether the court can look at the entirety of the record to go and make that determination. But the fact of the matter is that the court still has to go and follow its ball, the balls and strike calls, as noted by this court. And one of those is that when you have a sanction that is going to end the litigation, there is a separate set of rules that need to be followed. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
it please the court, good morning. Regarding this case, there's really only one issue that is before the court, and that is, did the district court, who according to long-standing Fifth Circuit precedent, must be vested with the power to manage their own affairs so as to achieve the orderly and expeditious disposition of cases, and whose enforcement of reasonable scheduling deadlines should not be lightly disturbed on appeal, abuse its discretion in granting a motion for evidentiary exclusion sanctions? Now, the two most important things I said right there, I believe, are the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and the order of the district court at issue is an order excluding evidence. It is not an order issuing litigation-ending sanctions. Significantly, the abuse of discretion standard is applicable in two important ways. First, the district court's imposition of sanctions is reviewed to determine if the court abused its discretion. And frankly, I don't think I heard it right there, and I don't think this court would find it, that there was an abuse of discretion because the plaintiff undeniably canceled an expert deposition repeatedly and failed to present.
How many times? I forgot, I've lost count. But at least two, is that correct?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. There is a long history, of course, set forth in the record associated with our efforts to get this expert deposed. In the end, the expert was never deposed in accordance with the court's order, and therefore there could really be no argument that the court abused its discretion in finding this misconduct warranted a just sanction.
Well, it sounds like each side's lawyers in the trial court were accusing the other side of gamesmanship.
Well, I hate to put it that way, Your Honor, but that may be...
I'm not saying that's fair. I'm just saying that it appears to be one of these sort of classic unfortunate situations where lawyers don't get along.
I've known counsel for many years, tried many cases against him. We do get along. Unfortunately, here, I don't think he was... I'm a little surprised he's not here today. He was not up to speed on the case at the district court level to realize, number one, that we were still within the discovery period. The offer of explanation that they made for canceling the deposition was we were outside the discovery period. That's set forth in the district court's analysis. So I was surprised that I was being accused of gamesmanship with respect to discovery, but that I think, as the district court said, even if that were the case, we don't do tit for tat. I had a request for the deposition. They had agreed to produce him on multiple occasions. They failed to produce him. They canceled it unilaterally. They engaged in self-help. And the court then issued a just sanction, which was exclusion of the expert. And that's the other aspect of the abuse of discretion standard, and perhaps more importantly is, particularly given the plaintiff's attempts at framing this as a litigation-ending sanction, the district court's determination of the appropriate legal test to be employed in the assessing of the sanction is, according to one of the most recent cases here in the Fifth Circuit involving this issue, the Kirkendall versus Accord Healthcare 966 Fed 3rd 351 case, that is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. So Judge Barker had the discretion to determine which legal test would apply, and he did that. And he determined this is not a litigation-ending sanction. This is a discovery sanction asking for the exclusion of evidence. This would be like if they had failed to produce documents during discovery, and the court then determines, well, I'm going to exclude that evidence. Now, what's the effect of that? Well, maybe that was the most critical piece of evidence in the case, but that was not what the court was determining in terms of, you know, that's litigation ending. No, the court was faced with a discovery issue and issued a just discovery sanction. Now, that's important here, again, because what the plaintiffs are trying to frame this is a litigation-ending sanction. They've actually suggested that there should be a four-prong test with regard to expert exclusion, and then they want a four-prong test with respect to litigation-ending sanctions. Really, I don't think either of those tests apply. Judge Barker actually did go through the expert exclusion prongs in his order, and it's set forth in the record, so I don't think he was required to do that. Under Compaq, in this case, or in this court, it was determined that the judge only has to determine if the sanction was just and specifically related to the claim at issue in the discovery order. And that's exactly what happened here. The court made a determination that the sanction was just, employing those four factors. Judge Barker went through, well, how important is this witness? What prejudice will befall Honda? Could I consider a lesser sanction? What was the plaintiff's excuse?
Why wasn't a lesser sanction considered?
Well, because there would be no appropriate lesser sanction. We certainly discussed this with Judge Barker during the hearing, and contrary to what plaintiff's counsel just suggested, that he didn't consider a lesser sanction, Judge Barker asked Mr. Subar, can you give me a lesser sanction? The court is contemplating a continuance. The court's contemplating ordering Honda to depose these experts, you know, right before trial.
There could be costs, right? I mean, fees and costs would be lesser.
Exactly. So the court did consider this and invited Mr. Subar, hey, can you come up with a lesser sanction for me to consider? Mr. Subar offered him nothing.
Where is that in the record?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where is that in the record? If you have a RA site.
Yes, Your Honor. It's going to be in the transcript, which I'm not sure what the record appeal number is, but it's going to be probably this. The colloquy begins on page 47 of the hearing transcript, Your Honor, and actually on 46, the court goes, I mean, just to put two options on the table, a trial date could be continued or depositions could be taken between now and April 18th. And he's asking Mr. Subar, which of those do you believe is appropriate, if any? And Mr. Subar says, you know, unfortunately, I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not the person that would be taking a product liability deposition. We're talking about the Schedule II experts. I don't know. You know, I don't know what to do in this situation. So there was no solution that was being offered. But to answer Chief Judge Richmond's question, there would be no lesser sanction. Here is the expert. The only option was to either preclude him from testifying or grant a continuance of a case that had already been continued. This was its third trial setting. We've expended tremendous resources and money getting the case ready for trial. Justice delayed, is justice denied? Judge Barker went through all of that in the analysis. I don't think he was even required to do that. I think what he was required to do under compact was come up with a just sanction that relates directly to the misconduct at issue. And the misconduct at issue was precluding discovery of these experts. The just sanction was to simply strike the experts. Now, the result of that ultimately became the granting of a summary judgment. But as both this court and the United States Supreme Court has said, that a particular legal consequence follows from the discovery sanction does not in any way affect the appropriateness of the sanction. So
I get that, but by that point in time, the designation deadline had passed. They could not designate another expert, I'm gathering. And so, we're blinking reality to say the judge didn't realize everybody realized it was a litigation-ending sanction.
I disagree, Your Honor. It's not litigation-ending in the sense that, number one, they could have tried to seek some further relief. They could have asked for a motion for leave. That's exactly what happened in Law Thunder versus Munoz, where that court determined, that's not litigation-ending sanctions simply because the pleadings were struck, because there's still other avenues of relief that could have been considered. Here, the plaintiffs did nothing,
But they didn't move for continuance? I thought they did.
No, they did not move for a continuance. And so I don't think that there was litigation ending immediately. That was the ultimate consequence here. But if you look at this product liability case, they pled causes of action in design, manufacturing, and warning.
And they didn't say, well, we'll make the expert available next week or 2 days from now?
They made no offer in that regard, Your Honor. Again, no alternative presented. And so in terms of the timing associated with this being litigation ending, no, it wasn't. What it was is we had some experts struck. If they had other evidence, maybe there was a recall on the product, or maybe there was something else. They had a warnings claim, but of course they couldn't advance evidence because Ms. Williams never read her owner's manual. So they had these other claims that, again, they could have brought forth evidence on, perhaps. They chose not to do so. They put all their eggs, I guess, in this basket of design defect, because that's really all the issue is in terms of this being litigation ending. It's not. It's claim ending. It's claim ending as to the design defect claim. They had to have an expert on design defect. When they lost this expert, they lost that aspect of their case. However, they could have advanced other evidence or done other work, and as Judge Barker pointed out when he granted the summary judgment, they brought me no additional evidence. So it's not some type of fiction or something in terms of it not being litigation ending. It was claim ending as to one specific claim, the design defect claim. So I think what we can examine the underlying factual issues, but of course that's reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard, and hopefully the record is sufficient. I think I heard counsel finally acknowledge that there really was no basis for canceling the deposition. It was a bad decision at the last moment, the day before the deposition, to pull down the expert. If you've seen the email traffic, I specifically cautioned my esteemed colleague who I've tried cases with, don't do this. Judge Barker is not going to appreciate this. This is not an appropriate path. And of course,
That is why, though, I'm sort of at least lightly suggest there could have been a lesser sanction of costs associated with having to prepare a deposition that was never took place. I mean, there are lesser sanctions in theory that could have worked.
Well, I think there's lesser.
That was forfeited by the other side, so be it. But
yeah, I think there's lesser theory or lesser sanctions that were considered by the court. And yes, in theory, there are lesser sanctions. That wouldn't be just. And I don't think Judge Barker abused his discretion in making that determination for all the records.
Why would that not have made you all whole or your client whole?
Well, in terms of making the client whole, Your Honor, I guess we would have to go back.
The delay aspect?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The delay aspect?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say the money's in the money. And in fact, at the trial court, I told Judge Barker this, yes, as an alternative, we of course asked for our costs back. That would be considerable. I said it wasn't insignificant, but that's really not the issue. That justice delayed is justice denied. When you've had three trial settings and you've tried for over a year to depose their experts, and it's met with this continued, I hate to say it, gamesmanship, but every time I asked for the expert, it was conditioned. I had to produce corporate representatives before I could take the deposition. I had to produce a crash test vehicle before I could get deposition dates. I had to take it only via Zoom, even though it was noticed for live in person, and they never moved for protection. I think that's the most offending thing here, is they never moved for protection at all as to these deposition notices. Zero. And it was self-help. And if we're going to allow litigants to engage in self-help, I really fear what is going to happen with regard to, I just did something that's really bad, but you can't sanction me, Judge, because I'll take it to the Fifth Circuit saying it's litigation ending, and I'll cite the Williams versus Honda case that says if there's something that somehow results in a litigation ending sanction, you, the trial court, no longer can do that. And of course, that really hamstrings the district court in the conduct of their business. District judges have to have the authority to manage their dockets, and we owe deference to their decisions whether and how to enforce the deadlines they impose. That's what happened here. We actually had moved these deadlines by agreement multiple times because I was trying to work with counsel, and even though my deposition notices were not being honored, and even though they finally agreed on a date certain, and the conditions had finally been removed, because, by the way, they never took our corporate representative deposition. That's part of the gamesmanship. I spent so much time and money prepping witnesses that they canceled twice, but I had to do that in order to even get deposition dates. So finally, they canceled my corporate representative deposition in October, having agreed to present their expert for deposition in November, and then, of course, the day before, they canceled that deposition as well. I think that on balance then, the sanction that was issued is just. I don't think you have to go through a four-prong litigation ending analysis If you were to do that, I think, frankly, that the case still warrants the finding that there was no abuse of discretion. I think the court applied the proper standard when it said, I have to determine whether the sanction is just and it's tied to the misconduct itself. This court has kind of explored, well, in the issue of litigation ending sanctions, should we require this four-prong, or law funder actually referred to it as a six-prong test? And there are other factors. If I was moving for immediate dismissal, if I was moving for some type of default, those are litigation ending sanctions. That's not what was requested here. This was an evidentiary exclusion sanction. And as I say, Judge Barker even went out of his way, I thought very well in his reasoned opinion, going through those four factors for excluding an expert. He listened to the excuse that I offered, and he found that it was not right or just. He considered how important the testimony would be. He knew that that would eliminate a design defect claim. Until he saw the rest of the record, he wouldn't know that that was litigation ending. It wasn't. It was claim ending, not litigation ending. He considered the potential prejudice in allowing the testimony, which would be huge.
Sorry, what do you mean claim ending, not litigation ending?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Claim ending, not litigation ending?
Claim ending only as to that design defect claim. They needed an expert on design defect.
That's a weird, I mean, what if that was the only claim they brought?
That's not the only claim they brought.
No, but why is that? I'm not sure I get that argument. I mean, litigation ending is litigation ending as to whatever claim you're talking about.
Well,
this strikes me as a weird dichotomy.
Yeah, again, I think it was the effect of it, of the sanction was claim ending. I don't think that's litigation ending, but yeah,
that strikes me as a better dichotomy.
Yeah, and again, as both this court and the Supreme Court has said, that a particular legal consequence follows from the discovery sanction does not in any way affect the appropriateness of the sanction. And I was going to note, of course, that Judge Barker did go through the four-prong touchstone of excluding the expert. He did listen again to their excuse. He considered the importance of the witness. He considered the prejudice that would flow. He determined whether or not he could cure the prejudice. And of course, he actually went further, even though I don't think he was required to, and considered, well, what are the other issues at stake here? And what will the deterrent effect be if I don't do this? And again, that is the concern I raised a moment ago. If we're going to allow litigants to engage in self-help and not allow the court to enforce its orders and to issue just sanctions, then I'm afraid that we will lose the demeanor and decor we should have at the district court level in terms of how discovery is conducted. Again, I'm glad to address any of the underlying factual issues. I would simply say that it's pretty replete with the efforts we made to depose these experts, and we were denied that, and no offer was made by plaintiffs to try to accommodate that. So in the end, we are asking that this court find that the sanction is issued by the district court after a thorough analysis of the underlying factual issues was just, that even if you wanted to employ the use of the four factors for excluding of an expert, the court did that. He did not abuse his discretion in finding that the misconduct of the plaintiffs was tied directly to the relief that was sought, and took into account the consideration of the issue, analyzed the prejudice to the non-defending party, determined whether a letter or sanction could remedy the issue. Given the thorough analysis that the court below conducted, I don't believe that this court could find that it abused its discretion, and therefore I think the decision should be affirmed. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
If I may, let me just cover a few points. First of all, we absolutely have never acknowledged that at the end of the day that we were not correct in not going forward with the deposition. I want to point out some language from a case that we cited, Phillips versus GMC, in which the court had the exact same situation happen. And here's what the last lines of the court's opinion were, the timing of the tests on the eve of the experts' depositions and after they submitted the reports would obviously derail the scheduled depositions and suggest the need for a trial delay. That is exactly what happened here. These tests came almost a year after they were already supposed to have been provided. The Fifth Circuit has made clear that when you talk that there's a difference between the discovery deadline and the expert deadline, and when it comes to tests, those tests are part of the expert deadline, not the discovery deadline. And the courts in the Fifth Circuit have absolutely agreed with that. Second thing is, it was interesting that counsel cited Kirkendall. I'm going to cite Clark versus Santa Fe, which I believe, Judge Ho, you were part of that opinion, where the court specifically stated, although they didn't apply it because it was an MIL case, that in fact, when you're talking about sanctions that will dismiss a case, that it's not really a two-part test and a four-part test, but as the court termed it, it was a six-part test. Counsel indicated that we never sought protection in this case. Of course we did. In fact, that was a huge part of our brief, where counsel earlier in the summer had tried to go and take a deposition, the deposition face-to-face, and we had to seek protection because until we found, as counsel indicated, a letter from his mommy to go and address the fact that he didn't want to sit across from directly across from somebody who had just gotten off an airplane because of some health concerns. So we absolutely had addressed that in the past. The counsel said, "Well, wait a second. Judge Barker stated from the bench that as to what he viewed as potentially lesser or greater sanctions, and therefore the court did consider it. And in fact, this court has specifically, in fact, Judge Ho, you were on vicus, where that very consideration was made. They went and they...
Why didn't the deposition take place in 2 days? Or why didn't that happen?
Well, and in fact, subsequent email, we explained exactly why, because we had just gotten the reports and we needed to see the testing. And in fact, there was a specific email, and I think I marked it, it's record 428. There was a specific email that in fact went and said, look, before we go and put on our litigation, if you want to go and use that new test that with the test that you guys had for over a month without bothering to turn over, we want to be able to go and see that testing. And in fact, in that email, we specifically go and say, we're more than happy to go and put up the experts, but we have to work on an even playing field and going and doing a test, holding the record for over a month until they didn't turn it over. We learned about it the day before the deposition. They didn't turn it over till the day after the deposition was supposed to take place. And that's part of the point, Your Honor, is that the fact of the matter is that the trial court, the district court, was more than happy to look at the entire record when it served the purpose of the district court's ultimately dismissing the case. And then the court was more than happy to go and look at different parts in a vacuum when that served their purpose. But when you look at the overall nature of the case, this clearly was not as well as the fact that, again, and I know I've said this a couple times, that this was the first time that there had never even been a motion to compel in front of the court before this. And the courts have made it very clear. You have to come and ask for something else before your first move is to ask for a sanction that would dismiss a case. Because there's no evidence of the law, not only of the to meet the two-part test, which I would note includes the client actually participating in the bad acts, as well as the law funder's six-part test, we believe that the court was committed reversible error and would ask that the case be reversed and remanded back to the court for trial on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That will conclude the arguments before this panel this week. The cases are under submission. Thank you.
May we excuse, Your Honor?
I'm sorry?
Excuse, Your Honor?
Yes. Thank you.